This is VOA News via remote. I'm Michael Brown. At this hour, heavy rain and strong winds from Hurricane Sally are hitting the Gulf Coast sections of the southern U.S. states of Florida and Alabama. Forecasters say the slow-moving Category 1 storm could bring threatening floods. The National Hurricane Center said more than 2 feet of rain is expected in some areas. Sally is the second storm to threaten the Gulf Coast in less than a month. The storm could wallop Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida with massive flash flooding and storm surges of up to 7 feet. President Donald Trump made emergency declarations for Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, which helps coordinate disaster relief. The hurricane is expected to dump between 10 to 20 inches of rain on the coast with isolated 30 inches downpours. South Sudan finance minister said his ministry does not have the money to pay government workers their past due salaries, dismaying civil servants who have been waiting for their paychecks since April or May. Government employees told VOA they are finding it more and more difficult to feed their families as their savings dwindle and commodity prices skyrocket. The finance minister told the National Assembly's Business Committee last week the government's inability to pay was due in part on the COVID-19 lockdown, devastating the global economy, including crude oil prices and revenue from South Sudan's oil production. As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny published a photo of himself in a Berlin hospital Tuesday as he recovers from a nerve agent poisoning last month in Siberia. Germany, France, and Sweden have concluded that Navalny was poisoned with a nerve agent, a Soviet-era agent that Britain said was used on a former Russian spy, Sergei Skripal, and his daughter in Salisbury, England, 2 years ago. Western countries have requested an explanation from Moscow, which says the accusations that it was involved in the poisoning are unfounded. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has accused the West of using Navalny's poisoning as an excuse to impose new sanctions on Moscow. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been pressured to punish Moscow by positioning work on nearly completed natural gas pipeline from Russia to Germany, rather postponing that work. U.S. President Donald Trump hosted a signing ceremony at the White House Tuesday for the normalization of relations between Israel and the Arab states of the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. While President Trump did not mention the Palestinians in his remarks during the signing ceremony, he acknowledged that the normalization agreements between Israel and the Arab nations was part of a broader diplomatic effort to pressure Palestinians into negotiating a peace deal. Gulf Arab countries had long conditioned full normalization of ties with Israel on it providing concessions and progress on the two-state solution, envisioning an independent Palestinian state alongside Israel. The Trump administration is touting the deal between Israel and the UAE and Bahrain as key foreign policy victories, just 2 months remaining before the November 3rd presidential election. Former Vice President Joe Biden, Trump's Democratic opponent, said he supports more countries normalizing relations with Israel in response to a recent VOA question, but also said he believes that Israel has to be prepared to work toward a genuine two-state solution with the Palestinians. And dangerously dirty air from the U.S. West Coast wildfires is seeping into homes and businesses. People in Oregon, Washington State, and California have been struggling for a week or longer under some of the most unhealthy air on the planet. Scientists and forecasters say the smog may linger for days or even weeks. Dozens of wildfires have burned across 4.5 million acres in California, Oregon, and Washington State since August. For details on more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today's Wednesday, September 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. West African leaders are unwavering on civilian leadership of Mali's transitional process.
The authority of heads of state restated and reaffirmed its position that the headship of the transitional government in Mali must be civilian.
Former Ivory Coast President Barbeau's party plots its next move following a constitutional court rejection of Mr. Barbeau's candidacy. Nairobi nurses protest over payment of allowances and salaries. UNHCR urges investigations after 10 refugees are killed in Uganda during a water conflict. And Liberia holds a national anti-corruption conference today, Wednesday.
I believe that some progress has been made both in investigating and prosecuting corruption. However, all these processes are not sufficient, and that is the whole motivating factor in conducting this national conference.
And Mali's liberalized abortion bill sparks a new debate. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. It appears leaders of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, have compromised on their demand for a 12-month transitional period in Mali. Sources close to Tuesday's mini-summit in Ghana's capital, Accra, between ECOWAS leaders and the National Committee for the Salvation of the People of Mali, say the ECOWAS leaders expressed their willingness to allow an 18-month transitional period. However, the regional leaders have maintained that the leadership of the transition and the prime minister should both be civilians. Laolu Akande is the spokesperson to Nigerian Vice President Yemi Osinbajo.
I think the conclusion of the meeting essentially is that the body does not accept any undemocratic change of government, and the authority of heads of state, which is the highest organ of ECOWAS, decided to keep speaking with one voice on the issue of democracy and good governance in Africa. But it refers to Mali that it will only accept the headship of a transitional government by a civilian, and that the traditional government should not in any situation exceed 18 months.
ECOWAS had requested for a 12-month transitional period. The military junta had said 18 months. Was there any compromise?
ECOWAS stood on its position, but added that any transition, first and foremost, has to be headed by a civilian, and that, you know, the maximum time that it could accept for the tenure of such a transitional government that is headed by a civilian is 18 months. The maximum time acceptable to ECOWAS would be 18 months.
ECOWAS had given the military junta September 15. Why did they say that they were not able to meet the deadline?
Well, you know, James, I won't be able to go into the details. I'm a spokesperson of the Nigerian government, specifically attached to the vice president. So I won't be able to go into the details, you know, but I can tell you basically that that was the outcome of the meeting.
What about the composition of the transitional government? Was there an agreement?
So the point about the composition is that it has to be led by a civilian. The authority of heads of state restated and reaffirmed its position that the headship of the transitional government in Mali must be civilian. That was the conclusion on that matter.
ECOWAS is against the idea of a military coup in the sub-region. The way it is going, does it seem that the military junta has won?
No, that was the point that I made, that the ECOWAS has maintained a united voice. The consensus among ECOWAS leaders is for the preservation of democracy in the sub-region and the complete unacceptance of any undemocratic change of government, including military. So ECOWAS insists that it will not accept a military change of government in the region, specifically regarding Mali, that what had happened is not acceptable, for which reason sanctions have been imposed, and that those sanctions will not be rescinded until and if the military transitional government in Mali is headed by a civilian, and it has been within 12 and 18 months max to hand over power to a duly elected democratic government.
Thank you so much, sir, for taking the time to talk with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, James.
Laolu Akande is the spokesperson to Nigerian Vice President Yemi Osinbajo. You are speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. Liberia is holding a national anti-corruption conference today, Wednesday. The fight against corruption, it seems, has eluded administration after administration. Former President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf declared corruption public enemy number one and vowed to eradicate it. The fight against corruption has somewhat been dormant during President George Weah's administration. Now, the country's anti-corruption commission is hosting a national conference today, Wednesday. But it appears the conference is getting off to a rocky start as one of the key invited organizations, the Liberian National Bar Association, has said it will not participate. Ndubuisi Mwabudike is the new chair of the anti-corruption commission.
As you know, James, our country is 100 and something more years. And from the very beginning of this country, there's always been a cry out by our people against corruption. Government after government have consistently spent money, spent time, designed policies to fight corruption. But obviously, we are not getting it very, very right. So the idea is to see what we are doing that we are not doing right, to see how we are reasoning that we're not reasoning right, and to see what changes need to be made. And when I say that, I don't mean we are trying to reinvent the wheel. But clearly, there is need for some changes. We commenced this in January. We had the first consultative meeting, including all the integrity institutions, all the stakeholders, civil society organizations, and donor partners. And we agreed that we'll plan a large national conference around this question of perception and designing a workable strategy to fight corruption. Unfortunately, the coronavirus came in, so things were delayed. But now that things are clearing out, we decided to proceed and complete what we started in January. We hope that His Excellency the President will have time to come and open the conference.
It seems to me that Liberia has not fared well in the last 3 years with groups like Transparency International when it comes to the fight against corruption. Looking at this, it seems, therefore, that your commission is facing a very tough challenge.
I agree with you that we are facing a tough challenge. But I also agree with you that our country has not been very, very successful in fighting corruption, and it's not in the past 3 years. Like I said earlier, this is something that's been on the table, it's been in existence since the founding of this country. I believe, actually, that some progress has been made in the past 3 years. Some successes has been recorded in fighting corruption, both in investigating and prosecuting corruption, and in conducting audits and conducting financial intelligence investigation. However, all these successes are not sufficient. A lot more is still required, and that is the whole motivating factor in conducting this national conference.
The Liberian Bar Association, which is one of the organizations invited by your commission to participate in today's conference, says it will not participate. I wonder, what do you make of that?
James, I told you from the very outset that this is a national endeavor. It is not politics. I'm not going to make comments on issues that surround politics. We invited all political parties, all civil society organizations in Liberia, all stakeholders. We don't expect that everybody will come, but we hope that as much as possible, people who are interested in fighting corruption should come. This is not about an individual. We should not make it a political subject or a subject around an individual. This is a national effort. And if you have idea and you can make contribution, this is a forum and time to make that contribution.
Ndubuisi Mwabudike is the new chair of the Liberia Anti-Corruption Commission. You are speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. In Ivory Coast, the party of former President Laurent Gbagbo says it will continue to seek changes in the country's constitutional court, particularly the court's president. The party also said it will fight for a new electoral commission. This comes after the country's constitutional court declared President Alassane Ouattara eligible to run for a third term in the coming October 31st presidential election. The court, however, rejected the candidacy of Mr. Gbagbo and former leader Gion Soro. Jean-Gervais Tchéide is the vice president for finance and budget of former President Laurent Gbagbo's party. He says the court's decision is a constitutional coup.
We are very, very sorry that the constitutional court is rather in politics than in law, because what we have seen yesterday is everything but not the implementation of law, of our constitution.
So what does your party plan to do next now that the candidacy of you, of Mr. Babo, has been rejected by the Constitutional Court? What's next now for the party?
Well, what I can tell you is that tomorrow, the Secretary General of the party and the President of our General Gathering, which we call ADS, will give a press conference, and we shall let you know what we are going to do next. But what we must know is that we will not resign. We will continue the political struggle because we consider that the decision of the Constitutional Court is not normal. It is not implementation of our Constitution. It is unconstitutional. So we shall continue to emphasize the fact that we have the right to be on the list. Our candidate has the right to run for this term. And we are going to denounce, the fact that Mr. Ouattara has been received as a candidate, which is also unconstitutional.
The candidacy of Henry Konan Bedie was validated. So some people are suggesting, is it possible for the opposition to come together to support Mr. Bedie?
Well, the first thing that everybody should know is that if Mr. Ouattara has decided, despite our constitution, it is not to lose the election, he is going to win the election by all means. Even if he is defeated, he will say that he is the winner. So what is important today is not the validation of Mr. Bedie's candidacy. It is the fact that Mr. Ouattara has decided to take, in fact, it is a coup. It is a constitutional coup. He is going to take power by force. So what we have to fight for is the conditions of these elections. Number one, change the constitutional court, especially the president, because he is a member of Mr. Ouattara's political. Number two, we must change the commission in charge of the election, the National Electoral Commission. And number three, we must have an audit of the list, the electoral list. If these three conditions are not put together, if we consider that if Mr. Bedie considers that he is a candidate, he can win in front of Mr. Ouattara, even if all the country votes for him, he will be defeated, because this is what Mr. Ouattara will decide. And we have seen that it is what Mr. Ouattara decides that the Constitutional Court implements. It is not the contrary. So we have to be intelligent and fight for good conditions of election.
Jean-Yves Tchéide is the vice president for finance and budget of former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo's party. You are speaking with us from the capital, Abidjan. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 16. Nurses in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, took to the streets yesterday, Tuesday, to demand improvement in their allowances and salaries. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, the workers accused the Nairobi Metropolitan Service of making empty promises.
Speaking outside the governor's office where the health workers held their protest, Boaz Ochari, chairperson of the Kenya National Union of Nurses, described some of the challenges he says are facing healthcare workers. He says the nurses have run out of patience because the authorities refuse to meet their demands.
Today we are here as health professionals. We are not here as nurses alone. We are here as health workers of Nairobi County. And we are here because of the notice that we gave our employer that there are injustices in this county that have not been addressed. And we gave him a notice and he has not shown any goodwill. That is why we are out. We are out so that our employer can address the issue of stagnations. We have our colleagues who have stagnated in one job group for more than 10 years. We have our colleagues who have worked for 5 years and their payslip still reads probation. So those are the issues we want our employer to address before we resume our duties.
Ochari says the nurses do not see their strike as an injustice to the millions of Nairobi residents who some say would be deprived of services because of the strike. He says nurses are also Kenyans facing similar challenges like access to quality health care.
You know, we are not from Tanzania. We are also Kenyans. We are not from Uganda. The same challenges our colleagues are facing are the same challenges we are facing. We don't have any medical cover. Today, if Boaz or any kin related to Boaz was to fall sick, depends on the hospitals that where we are not serving right now. So if we, the people, we are also suffering because we are not at our workstations to attend to ourselves, even to our colleagues. So let it not be like when we are out, Kenyans are suffering, but when we have injustices, it is not something to be taken about.
Charles Kanji, chairperson of the Kenya Union of Laboratory Technicians, echoed the same sentiments and urged the authorities to pay nurses' salaries by the 5th of each month.
Understand how life is difficult to move around without a salary. Today is 15th of September. We need salaries to be paid by 5th of every month so that we can enable our members to move around and offer services to the patients in Nairobi. Promotion. We are missing out on promotion. People are not being promoted as the scheme of service demands. So our bare minimum is stagnation, promotion, and salary be paid on time.
Tuesday strikes come at the end of a 14-day notice to the Nairobi County Government. The county government met last week Friday, but did not reach a consensus on the nurses' demands. The protest comes at a time when Kenya's COVID-19 caseload continue to rise, with Nairobi leading the country. Kenya's Ministry of Health Chief Administrative Secretary, Dr. Mercy Mwangangi, reported on Tuesday that Kenya now has 634 deaths. New cases rose from 48 on Monday to 96 on Tuesday. Kenya's total caseload now stands at 36,301. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, and the Ugandan authorities are working to restore peace after clashes between locals and refugees in northern Uganda last week left about at least 10 refugees dead. The violence followed an argument between South Sudanese refugees and the host community at a shared water point. Rights activists say the fighting underscores scarce resources in Uganda, which hosts Africa's largest population of refugees. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees in Uganda is calling for calm and an investigation into the violence that left the refugees dead. The incident last Friday also left 19 refugees injured and 10 others missing. Officials say it happened when a dispute near a shared water tap at the Tika village in the Rhino refugee settlement turned violent. Joel Butro, the UNHCR representative in Uganda, says the violence was alarming.
The disproportionate violent reaction by the host community to what was a communal dispute signals a threat to the delicate balance of peaceful coexistence in the rural villages where refugees live alongside their Ugandan hosts. In an environment of scarcity of resources, tragic incidents such as that of last Friday are alarming.
The UNHCR also points out that 15 refugee houses were burned to the ground and another 26 looted and vandalized. Muse Chweru, Uganda's State Minister for Refugees, told VOA the incident was regrettable and said investigations are underway. According to Chweru, refugees beat and killed a child from the host community for reasons unknown. This triggered what he called the disproportionate reaction from local residents. He said that the incident shows weaknesses in the refugee support system that needs to be addressed.
The first one is psychosocial support to the refugees first, to really let the Dinkas and all these communities know that violence must not be all the time employed when there is a kind of a misunderstanding. They could have been annoyed by this child, but beating the child to death was not something that was necessary.
The UNHCR has deployed teams on the ground to support refugees traumatized by the attack. Acheng Akena, executive director for the International Refugee Rights Initiative, notes that community resources are being stretched thin, especially now that Uganda is facing an economic crunch due to coronavirus restrictions, which have made life very difficult for many people, especially refugees. Akena says both the government and the UNHCR need to not only effectively implement peaceful community mechanisms, but stop being reactional.
There needs to be appropriate punishments done and appropriate, prosecutions of the people who have been accused of having committed these offences. The biggest challenge is if this goes unresponded to, or if the community feels that justice was not served, the next conflict will be even worse.
Refugee rights activists note that as the world continues to focus on COVID-19, the illness caused by the virus, it could mean increased tension between refugees and their host communities if one side perceives the other to be competing for scarce resources. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Anti-abortion activists in Malawi are protesting plans by the National Assembly to debate a bill that would allow abortion in cases of rape and incest. Malawi's abortion rights activists argue the determination of pregnancies bill would help prevent the 12,000 deaths annually from illegal, unsafe abortions. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Abortion is currently illegal in Malawi and punishable by a maximum of 14 years in prison, except in cases where pregnancy threatens the life of a woman. Proponents of the termination of pregnancy bill says the restriction is forcing women to seek illegal abortion services, mostly from untrained personnel. Government statistics indicated that 70,000 women in Malawi have illegal abortions each year, and 17% of them die from the procedure. Dr. Amos Nyaka is vice chair for the Coalition for Prevention of Unsafe Abortion, which is championing liberalized abortion laws in Malawi.
From the public health point of view, I think it would be important to address this issue of complications that arise from termination of pregnancies. And I think that's why I think it's important that this be discussed and it be looked at in terms of how we can protect women from dying from terminations of pregnancies.
The bill would also allow victims of rape under age 6 and incest to end their pregnancies. At a press conference Monday, anti-abortion activists, mostly religious groups, asked the National Assembly not to discuss the bill, which is expected to be presented during the current sitting of Parliament. Thomas Nsusa is the chairperson for the Episcopal Conference of Malawi. He says the government should not champion the measure, which he says promotes killings.
But if anything, they don't really listen to what they are saying, for sure we will not remain silent. We will call for another course of action, whether that would be the same as what we did in 2016 or another way of doing things until what God calls us for should be listened.
In 2016, a group of anti-abortion activists led by the Catholic Church marched to Parliament to stop lawmakers from discussing the legislation. Brian Banda is the presidential press secretary. He told reporters in the capital, Lilongwe, Monday, that President Lazarus Chakwera cannot prevent Parliament from discussing the measure.
What the president is saying, people that have views against this bill, they should discuss. Being a private member's bill, they should lobby members of Parliament on how they should deal with this matter.
The lawmakers are expected to debate the bill before the current sitting of Parliament ends on October 23. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And that's it for this Wednesday, September 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Shryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butt in Washington saying, have a good day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them. and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with our voices on VOA.